in this new normal. But I do think if people were to grasp, you know, how could we get more people in the room, right? Because we are virtual, and not just hear from one or two perspectives, but what, let's get all the other people in the room who typically wouldn't come to our meetings, right?
Right.
Join us on Zoom, and let's have a brainstorming meeting about how to solve this really difficult problem. Then you've got more heads, right? More creativity, more cultural perspectives as well.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today is the first in a two-part conversation centered on cultural fluency with global leadership strategist and corporate coach Jane Hyun. Jane is the author of Leadership Toolkit for Asians and Breaking the Bamboo Ceiling, Career Strategies for Asians, and co-author of Flex, the new playbook for managing across differences. In this episode, Steve and Jane discuss how leaders can get the best out of their workers in a remote work environment, as well as practical ways leaders can facilitate productive meetings with teams spread out all around the globe.
So, Jane, it's lovely to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, and thanks for having me. It was a lovely surprise to hear from somebody across the pond.
Well, we'll come to that issue of cultural fluency a little bit later on and how you deal with people in different parts of the world. But I wanted to start because you're something of a global strategist. You're a trusted coach to multinational companies. And indeed, you know, you've worked with thousands of leaders across, you know, different continents to increase their agility to drive business growth and innovation. And that's where I wanted to start today. Lots of people listening into this podcast obviously are being challenged at the moment with the concept of growth. Markets are pretty tough, very, very changeable, really difficult, I think, for people to get their arms around where things are moving. And yet the need to innovate is still there. So how do you begin that journey of working with a leader who says, you know, Jane, I'm struggling a bit here. Give me some help.
You post some really interesting and timely issues of the moment, Steve. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, we're coming off a couple of years after the pandemic. I think businesses are still struggling to survive in some cases. I know I'm based here in New York, and there's a lot of storefronts that are still closed or may never come back again, and not being rented, you know, for the future. So I think there's still a lot of uncertainty. The question you ask about how do we even begin to work with a leader or an organization to help them perhaps diagnose, you know, where they are with things. I think, you know, many times that we work with organizations, they come to us and they usually have some issue they're dealing with. It's, you know, they've got a global team. They're struggling with growth. They're dealing with attrition. You know, people are leaving their organization and they have to deal with the retention issues and all of that. So kind of a myriad of business and leadership issues and people issues that are at play. So I would say the way we kind of tackle looking at this is really diagnosing it, right? And giving them a snapshot for how they're navigating around differences in the moment. So we do that kind of in the aggregate, but also for individuals, because, you know, as an interculturalist, I work individually with people as well as in a group. And so it's helpful for people to understand how do we as a team or a business, how do we tend to navigate around difference? Do we ignore it completely because we don't know what's going on? Do we tend to evaluate it and judge one perspective as better than another? Do we tend to minimize it, right? We see it as an issue, but we kind of just don't really focus as much on it. Or do we deeply lean into those differences to figure out what do we need to adapt and how do we need to adapt in order to get the outcomes that we're looking for? And so I think the most important thing that we try to do, if they're willing to go there, right? Because some people are not ready for the deep stuff, is to really just diagnose very objectively and give them a picture, just really reflect back to them, here's where you are now. And then we can determine where do you want to go? You know, what are the goals? But without kind of that moment in time where you have an accurate reflection of how you think about these things, it's difficult to know what kind of training to provide, right? It's difficult to know what steps to take to switch direction or course correct if they're going in the wrong path. So I would say that's probably the first step in working with an individual or a team or organization.
And I think, you know, it's also about them recognizing that things could be better. And I'm being deliberate about my choice of words there, rather than looking at it from a negative perspective. You know, it's about improvement and recognizing that things could be better. And I suppose confronting the fact that they need some external support in order to make that jump. And I like to think that business leaders today and have got to a point where they've gone beyond that, you know, I'm failing, so therefore I need to do something remedial, to looking at it much more from a business improvement, how do I get the most out of my people perspective. But to the point you're making, they still have to make that initial first step, right? And that they need to be quite brave to do that.
Absolutely. I think you hit upon a really important point. One, things could be better, but when do they get to the point where they say, it's up to me to do something too, right? And it's up to me. And to that point, I think the hardest thing is that self-awareness, that deep self-awareness. And if I could use this word, deep cultural self-awareness about who I am and how do I interact with people who are not like myself? And what role do I play in that world, right? If I'm part of the dominant culture, right? I'm an insider, I kind of know how things work. You may not even be aware of culture, right? You may not be even aware of things because maybe you default to, for the most part, we're human. And so even though there are some surface differences, we can figure things out if we can focus on our commonality. But people from the non-dominant culture, like myself, born in another country, moved to US and grew up in New York, which is very multicultural, I had to figure out things all for myself. And so I'm always aware of difference, right? I'm always aware of the culture differences that are there. But what I've done over time is sometimes, especially when I was younger and I was growing up in this multicultural world and society, I've had to sort of mute the aspects of myself that were different in order to fit in, right? In order to acculturate into this world, because I just wanted to be accepted. I just wanted to be like everybody else, right? But then I realized as I matured, you know, there's nothing wrong with my cultural background, and really I had to lean into who I was, you know, right. The values that my parents and the things that I learned from my Korean community are really interesting and good and helpful and could be a driver for innovation for the work that we do. And until I got to that point, I don't think my work was able to truly flourish in the way I could. So I think the work we do, I think, works for people who, how would I say this, who are from non-dominant culture backgrounds, but also from dominant culture backgrounds, to determine, you know, how do we see our business? How do we see our talent in ways that perhaps takes me out of my comfort zone, right? That widens my perspective of the world.
It's interesting you make the point about COVID, you know, post, you know, 2 years or whatever it is now, post-COVID, because for me, that was something of a turning point. I think that really brought home to a number of people the fact that there was actually a big world out there when it comes to people who don't have to physically be in the same location, who can work very adequately from different countries, different regions in the world. And actually bringing all of that together can really deliver significant value to an organization. You talk about, you know, innovation and bringing different cultural norms and views into that to drive innovation. But for me, that was certainly something that I probably wouldn't have seen come about so strongly had it not been for the pandemic, because we were forced into that environment. Is that something that you've seen in your work with other organizations?
Yeah, I think so. I think with the pandemic, the world definitely got smaller, you know, in so many ways. So, you know, you went from going into the office every day, having meetings in person, and maybe you had a couple of conference calls and maybe one or two video conference calls once in a while, to the point where we always met on Zoom. Right. We always had to figure out how to connect with people. And globally, you know, we couldn't travel anymore. And so instead of going to countries in Asia and the Middle East and in Latin America to have your meetings or connect with offsites on your teams, you had to do it virtually. And so I think the world did very much get smaller, for sure, which presents its own challenges, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're not able to have the in-person interactions. I'm not able to really read some of the nonverbal cues as readily. But to your point about innovation, for sure, I think when people could kind of move past survival mode, right? Because right. I think for a while it was, how do I even do my job, you know, from my home? And how do I have meetings with people I've never met before if they're new to the company? And how do I train them to do the work that they need to do? So there was this kind of a period of transition and onboarding and getting used to working in this new normal. But I do think if people were to grasp, you know, how could we get more people in the room, right? Because mm-hmm. we are virtual and not just hear from one or two perspectives, but what, let's get all the other people in the room who typically wouldn't come to our meetings, right?
Right.
Join us on Zoom and let's have a brainstorming meeting about how to solve this really difficult problem. Then you've got more heads, right? More creativity, more cultural perspectives as well. So as long as we could harness those perspectives into something productive, because sometimes when you get too much, chaos ensues. Mm-hmm. And so I think if the facilitator is culturally adaptive or fluent enough to understand how to vary the ways that they get the input, I definitely think more innovative ideas can come to fruition. And then from there, you can think about how do you execute on some of those ideas.
Yeah, the onus certainly falls back very much, doesn't it, onto the facilitator to get the best in those kinds of remote working environments. Now, for people who are listening to this, because you know, I'm very familiar with a number of organizations that simply never went back to the way that it was. They really fell into this sort of remote working. They've embraced the notion of having digital nomads working for them and all the benefits that that brings. But I still hear people talk to me about how difficult it is sometimes. To try to understand, to try to get, you know, somebody engaged on because they're not there. Mm-hmm. Have you got some sort of tips for people who are thinking, yeah, you know, I could probably brush up a bit on some of my facilitation skills and bring in some of those different cultural aspects? Any tips that they could take away?
Yeah, absolutely. And this works for remote settings as well as in person. But I think particularly if you're on a Zoom, you can control and do breakout rooms and things. I think one thing that's difficult to do when you have a lot of people is to get everybody's input.
Right.
Because if you've got 50 people on your Zoom thing and you've got 50 faces, how do you make sure that you do hear from the marginalized voices, but also figure out how to navigate and weed through that? I would say using as many opportunities to pre-wire the meetings before mm-hmm. the meeting would be helpful. So thinking about a kind of a loose agenda for what you'd like to accomplish, maybe asking a few different people who might be in the meeting who work in different groups that represent different groups to think about what are some ideas that we might want to surface? What are some questions we might want to surface in the meeting so that we hear from different perspectives? And then in the meeting itself, using breakout rooms, you know, pair groups, as well as the larger setting, because sometimes in the larger setting, people are afraid to raise their hand. Mm-hmm. And I think this is difficult, especially when in high power distance cultures or collectivist cultures where they don't want to stand out, right? They don't want to say something that might rock the boat versus right. US. I don't know about the UK, but in the US, we talk about the squeaky wheel gets the grease, mm-hmm. or the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So if you're not ringing that bell, if you're not speaking out, then no one's going to really know. Whereas there's a Chinese proverb that I've often quoted, the loudest duck gets shot, mm-hmm. or the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. So if you stand out too much, that's not good. You don't want to make too many waves, you know? Yeah. So those different perspectives might be at play. And so in the meeting itself, as much as you can do to pre-wire the meeting, and then in the meeting itself, perhaps having small breakouts, pairs, threes, where there's some socialization of their ideas, and then they can bring it back as well, could be some things. And then after the meeting, I think we often forget about, I think the protocols of meetings often just happen, and then we don't think about the pre and the post. But after the meeting, you can follow up with those two or three people you may have spoken to before the actual meeting and ask them what they thought, what were some takeaways, and how do we actually actionize some of the ideas that came to the surface?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people, you know, breathe a sigh of relief once the meeting's over, and then they're on to the next.
They go on to the next, like that was yesterday, right? Yeah. yeah, I know. I'm guilty of that sometimes too. Yeah.
So that circling back is certainly one of the things I think we can all do a little more of.
We'll be back next week with the second half of the conversation with this week's guest, Jane Hyun. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast. And we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.